And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. Regular listeners will know that over the past 11 years or so, I've devoted quite a lot of time to trying to understand better aspects of life in the United Kingdom. I grew up there, I'm a citizen of that country, and yet I've now lived more years out of it than in it, so I don't claim to be really current. My guest today will help further my understanding, and yours, better if you, like me, have an interest in the subject. He's one of the most prominent and respected of the generation of British academics born not one but two generations after the end of World War II. Thus, he sees political and social change through a different lens than the political scientists that I grew up with, and because of his relative youth, has a shorter personal perspective on past events. Now, he's visiting Geneva to address the British-Swiss Chamber of Commerce just after this interview, and we're in a quiet corner of the very comfortable Hotel Royal in the heart of the city. Dr. Matthew Goodwin is Professor of Politics at the School of Politics and International Relations at the University of Kent in the historic English city of Canterbury. He's also a commissioner of the Social Mobility Commission, and he'll no doubt explain what that means to us in our conversation. He's well-published, having written a number of successful books, and his current one is on sale now. It's called Values, Voice, and Virtue, and I commend it to you. Welcome to Geneva, Professor Goodwin. Welcome to the McKay Interview, and thanks for making time for me and our listeners before the main part of your day, your address to the BSEC, begins.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm really looking forward to our discussion today in Geneva.
It's going to be loaded and full of lots of interesting portent.
And incredibly timely.
Absolutely. I'm sure you'll explain why you say timely as we have our conversation. Professor Goodwin, Matt, if I may, seen from this distance of Switzerland, having not been to the UK since just before COVID-19, and not having lived there for almost 40 years, the UK does not seem to be doing well these days, at least on the home front. Though I've never been an expat who takes pleasure in knocking Britain when living abroad, reading the news, listening to the radio and watching TV these days reminds me of the UK that I once lived in as a young man with a young family in the late 1970s and early 80s when I left there never to return, I've never been back. High mortgage rates, 17 to 18%, as I recall, wage inflation approaching 20%, loss of national confidence, backbiting, blame gaming, strikes, and more strikes. That's what it was like then. Now, my question is, does history repeat itself, or as Mark Twain once said, it only rhymes? What's your broad assessment of the state of the UK today?
Well, I think that's a very apt description. If you look through the post-war history of Britain, we have often succumbed to what we call bouts of declinism, this belief that actually things are getting worse, that the future is going to be worse than the present, that the present is already worse than the past. And you saw that certainly in the 1960s, you saw it in the 70s, as you say, and also for some people they saw it during some of the years of Margaret Thatcher. I think where the country is today, in the aftermath of that seismic Brexit referendum, in the aftermath then of the COVID pandemic, and now amid inflation and political chaos, let's not forget we have just had three prime ministers in the last 12 months. Britain is, I think, once again asking itself, who are we? Where are we going? What is our place in the world? And how are we going to use these newfound freedoms to try and shape that journey? So when I speak to many of my fellow colleagues and citizens in Britain, and I'm living just north of London in Hertfordshire, there is a general sense of pessimism about the country. There is a sense that our current generation of leaders might not be up to the task of resolving those problems.
These are your contemporaries that you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. People in the universities, yeah, in the city. And I think it's fair to say there is a question hanging over both of the main parties, that when you look back at previous bouts of declinism, they have often been followed by conviction, missionary leaders who have a radical vision, a very different vision of where they want to take the country. I think today people look at our political class and they don't really see a visionary. They don't really see somebody with a long-term plan for turning the country and turning Brexit, Britain, around. And so we are, I think, in another bout of declinism.
So it's part of a rhythm in a way, or a cyclical kind of sense within the
country. Yeah, I think that's true. When I was writing my recent book, Values, Voice and Virtue, I ended up reading a book by a former Financial Times journalist called Michael Shanks in the 1960s, and you might remember this. It was called The Stagnant Society, and it was a best-selling book, sold about 60,000 copies. And he made the observation that the problem with Britain in the 1960s is that it had lost a sense of belief in itself. It didn't really have the innovation, the dynamism that was needed to refashion its economy. And of course, you lived through the consequences of some of that in the 1970s. And I think when you look at the conversation in Britain today, I think there is, again, a sense of confusion over this stagnant society. Productivity is low, growth is low. Brexit has brought many challenges. We'll come on to talk about those. This notion of levelling up the left-behind regions hasn't really worked, and the leadership that we've had hasn't really delivered so far on some of the advantages that you could have had and seized upon through Brexit. So there's definitely a question hanging over the elites in British society.
So as you said, societies evolve. Sometimes they progress, sometimes they regress. But it's only human to want to improve our lives and the life prospects of our children. The generation of my parents, that is the generation of your grandparents, having survived the death and destruction of World War II, probably had simple goals because life was possibly less complicated then. After all, they'd survived. They were alive and they had young families to raise. I'm talking about the Britain of 45, 46 and that period up to the swinging 60s. But my second question to you is more particular. What is your analysis today of today's adult generation? If you could go into it in a little bit more detail. Your generation, born in Britain in the 1970s, the Britain of Heath, Wilson, Callaghan, and right at the very end of the decade of Margaret Thatcher, of that decade, Margaret Thatcher, what in political and social terms does your political analysis tell you was bequeathed to them by their parents? By that I mean bequeathed by my generation to yours. What reins do you, Matt, hold in your hands today, and what are your contemporaries' worries and aspirations? It's a rather long question, but give me a sense of...
No, I think it's an important question because the intergenerational contract was always premised on the idea that your children would lead a more prosperous and successful life than you did. And for the first time in post-war British history, we now have a generation of middle-aged, often young parents who no longer believe in the intergenerational contract, who are skeptical that their children will lead a better life than they did. And part of that story is economic. Part of that story is linked to the housing crisis that we have in the country, the fact that it is simply impossible for my students, for example, from Gen Z, my first year university students were born in 2004, which will make both of us feel a little bit old. But, for them to get onto the housing market today is almost impossible, needing a deposit that is upwards of £100,000. But it's also cultural. I think there is a profound sense among my generation is Gen X, was born in 1981. I'm also technically known as a geriatric millennial, which is a term that has come that is used to define the older millennials, who are culturally and politically quite different from the younger millennials.
I've not heard that expression before. But
for my generation coming through as well, I think it's also cultural. It's a sense that the new issues on the agenda, whether that's climate change, whether it's around social justice, whether it's around how we carve out a new sense of who we are, what is Britishness in a increasingly multicultural, diverse world. Those questions that I think unite younger generations are not being adequately addressed by our political leaders. So what you're seeing, for the first time in British history, I should add, is you're now seeing about 80% of the under 35s saying they're going to vote for parties on the liberal left. We've never seen that before. This is a new phenomenon. And pensioners rallying around the Conservatives in a much bigger way than even during the days of Margaret Thatcher. So the age divide in Britain has become a much more prominent part of our politics. Now, when you were living in the UK in the 70s and going into that Thatcher era, the young and old really were not that different in how they voted. Today it's become a very dominant fault line in our politics, and that's partly because of these very different economic, social, and cultural experiences that are pushing them apart. But I think also if you look at the legacy of those earlier prime ministers and those earlier regimes, I think one of the blunt realities is that they did many things that were necessary at the time. You look at Thatcher, she reformed the economy, she put financial services in London on steroids. But there is now a consensus among economists in Britain that Brexit, the rise of Boris Johnson, the rise of populism, much like our European neighbours, was at least indirectly caused by the legacy of those earlier prime ministers.
Can I just ask you just a quick corollary to that before we move on? What does the data show over the last, let's say, 40, 50 years about the likelihood to actually vote amongst young people compared with older people, as opposed to an intention to vote?
Yeah, sure. So we have about a 30-point gap in turnout rates among young and old, which is, again, large and growing. So, look, if people often ask me, how is Boris Johnson able to win an 80-seat majority? How was... why was Jeremy Corbyn crushed at the 2019 general election when he had so much support among young people? There are two things you need to really understand about British politics today. One is baby boomers are 30 points more likely to turn out and vote, and they're a larger generation, much larger generation than Gen Z or millennials. Mm. People forget this.
Numerically,
there are many more of them. And the second thing is the education divide in politics today between graduates and non-graduates is geographical. So graduates are concentrated narrowly in the cities and university towns. So in a first-past-the-post system, both of those things basically give parties that appeal to older voters and those who haven't passed through university a really big advantage. And that advantage, of course, was one that put Boris Johnson in. People say, how was Boris Johnson able to win all of this support? Well, I'll tell you why. He mobilised the over-60s in an enormous way, but he also became the leader of the non-graduate majority.
Mm-hmm. It's good to make that point. My guest today is Dr. Matthew Goodwin, who's professor of politics at the University of Kent in the UK, and we're talking about his analysis of the political and social landscape in Britain today. Let's talk practicalities for a while, Matt, because I see the clock is racing ahead. If the wheel that moves society round and onward is broken, how to fix it? Speaking as a political scientist, what do you see as the necessary remedial steps?
Well, if you look at Britain today, I would say the big steps, the big challenges, one is we need to boost productivity as quickly as possible, and we need to produce a new political economy that can deliver growth. And when we talk later today here in Geneva about this, one of the points I'm making is that Britain simply no longer has a political economy that is capable of doing that. We need to look much more seriously at the growing polarization, not just in politics, but along the lines of geography and culture. We are, I fear, following America into very polarizing culture wars over our history, our identity, and who we are. And I've yet to see a leader emerge in British politics capable of bringing these different sides together. And one enormous thing that I know everybody will be thinking that I've not mentioned yet is the union. The union is weaker than at any time in my life. I'm 41 years of age. Scotland was on the verge of leaving, came very close. Wales, you're beginning to see similar rumblings there. Ireland, Northern Ireland, of course, enormous tensions, much of which have been exacerbated by Brexit. The lack of a unifying story about who we are is also running through this fragmenting United Kingdom. My daughter is 18 months. By the time she's 50, will the UK be together? Will it be a functioning, viable, multinational state? I'm sceptical of that, Michael.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about social class, something that interests me. Again, because I've been away a long time and I see it as things evolve. Tell me how you see and analyse the different social class groups in the UK today. Are the old A, B, C, 1, C, 2, D, E categories that I was familiar with as a young man, as a student in the 50s and 60s, are they obsolete? And in your writings, you talk a lot about elites. Who are they today? What is the middle class, the working class in the UK these days? And do these tags have meaning anymore? I mean, what tags or description do you use?
Well, it's a great question, because if you talk to the leading experts on class in Britain at Nuffield and Oxford and so on, many of my colleagues, they will tell you that the power of social class in Britain, which, remember, in the words of George Orwell, is the most class-ridden society on earth, the power of class has been diminishing as each generation replaces the last. And if you look at the last 10 years of elections in Britain, one of the remarkable facts is that class was a weak predictor of how people voted at those elections, because education and age have become much more important.
And the data shows that.
So class has gradually weakened as a driver. At the same time, we've seen these growing divides over education, which is why I talk about the rise of a new elite in British society. And let me be clear about what I mean by the word new, the term new elite. I'm referring to the new middle class, university educated, typically urban professionals who work in the knowledge sector, the creative sector, who tend to be economically secure, if not affluent, and who crucially, Michael, are leaning left on cultural questions. Over the last 10 years, they've moved sharply leftwards. They've become much more supportive of migration, much more supportive of the European Union, much more supportive of diversity, much more socially liberal. Now, why is this a challenge? It's a challenge because, unlike the old elite, the sort of Tory old boys elite who used to hang out in the private members' clubs on Pall Mall, well, they were economically detached from everybody else, but they were culturally conservative. They believed in the country. They believed in the institutions. They were, you know, small c conservative and patriotic. The new elite, I think, are different. I think they are skeptical, if not cynical, about the country and its history and its past. And in on that dimension, they are moving away from most voters, which again is why we've seen all of these populist upheavals.
So you don't mean it as a pejorative, just as an observation of a change in the society.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what I'm drawing on arguments that have been made by many thinkers before me: Daniel Bell in the 1970s, Christopher Lash in the 1990s, scholars who said, look, the elite is essentially breaking into two or three competing elite groups, and the new elite, the new middle-class graduate elite who dominate the institutions, who dominate the BBC, the universities, the civil service, many other institutions in British society, they're good people, they want to make the world a better place. But the problem is, they have drifted so far leftwards on culture, they no longer reflect the values of a majority of voters. Now, I have raised this, and I've been fairly criticised in some newspapers for making that point, the Financial Times and others, because I do not want to see Britain become America. And closing the gap between the elites and the masses is one of the primary challenges facing all Western democracies, because unless we do that, we're going to have more of what we had over the last 10 years, from America to Austria to France to Sweden. And I don't need to tell the Swiss or an audience in Switzerland, right at the heart of everything, just how much political churn and change you've seen around you in other democracies in Europe. Britain, of course, historically avoided that. I want Britain to avoid that, but that means we need to look seriously at whether this new elite is representing the wider country.
And the Swiss, because of the nature of the way the democracy is structured, work very hard on what they call cohesion, and they've got four languages as well.
But you also have a direct conception of democracy.
Absolutely.
I imagine many Swiss looked at the Brexit referendum and thought, well, having a referendum is entirely natural.
Absolutely.
I think, you know, debating these questions. And I suspect, last point, that the Swiss, and especially many of the people we'll be discussing these issues with today, probably looked at the Brexit vote and they might have thought, okay, that's the wrong decision, or I'm not sure what I feel about that. But they would have recognised the British people's concerns over free movement EU institutions.
That's right. I had a former president of Switzerland on this show talking about respecting the will of the majority. But as I see, also recognise that if you're in a democracy that only has a referendum once every generation, they're not that practised at it.
Well, so, I can be completely candid with you, Michael, and say I was one of a very few academics, about 10% of academics, who in the aftermath of the referendum, you know, no matter what we thought about the actual question, said, actually, for the sake of democracy, we need to implement this vote. I didn't campaign for Brexit. I would never have described myself as a Brexiteer. But I thought, for the sake of democracy, we needed to see that through.
Look, today's a very significant day in the UK because of the publishing later today, literally almost as we speak, of some very significant figures on immigration, migration, particularly illegal immigration. It's been a political hot potato, as you know, for a while. British politician Nigel Farage, who's been a guest on the British Swiss Chamber of Commerce stage about 10, 12 years ago, made a successful campaign out of the lead-up to Brexit and forced the mainstream parties to the right. The Conservatives have made pledge after pledge after pledge, which have failed. How would you analyse and characterise this aspect of British political and social life today? Is the UK still a welcoming society? Are foreigners welcome, Matt? And the immigration debate seems like political poison and cast the UK, to many of us, in a very poor light when we look back in the UK from abroad.
Well, I'm glad you've asked this question because I think it's the most pressing question in British politics, which is how can we, in the aftermath of Brexit, rebuild a society and an economy that brings people together and doesn't push them apart? And my concern, a controversial view you might say in Britain, is that actually our leaders have failed to learn the lessons of Brexit. And what they've done is they've doubled down on this policy of mass migration, which is basically contributing to an economy that is not growing and is unproductive and in which companies can rely on cheap workers from abroad. So here's one of the what we call the populist paradox in British politics, and this is really interesting, just new research that came out this year. Levels of racism and prejudice in Britain have never been lower. Our attitudes to immigration have softened since Brexit, right? Yet at the same time, we've seen the rise of these figures like Nigel Farage and Jacob Rees-Mogg or Suella Braverman, who take a very particular view on some of these questions. And I think that is ultimately because many people who are tolerant and welcoming and open to people from abroad can also sense that the regime that we have now in this country is not respectful of the stability and the order and the slow change that they want to see enacted.
Look, as time is moving on, I just wanted to talk to you about the National Health Service. How has it come to be elevated as something approaching a national deity when it seems to be failing in so many ways? And how significant is this in the context of Britain's apparent growth in self-doubt?
It's a great question again, because the National Health Service is often said to be the closest thing we have to a national religion. But at the same time, waiting lists for appointments have never been higher. Trying to get an appointment to see a GP is a nightmare. And the system itself is not functioning anywhere near the level that it should be functioning. Now, if you talk to people in Westminster, as I do every week, you'll get different interpretations. Some will say it's a hangover from COVID. Others will say it's a specific pressures coming from a rapidly growing population. But the reality, Michael, and I say this as somebody whose parents and cousins all work in the National Health Service, the reality is we've pumped the NHS full of money. We're spending about $190 billion a year on National Health Service and social care, and we've never reformed it. We've never actually made it work. We've never even been able to have a discussion about what alternative health systems like those in France or Germany and elsewhere could perhaps be brought into the UK to make the system more efficient.
Why do you think that is? Because it seems like an obvious question.
I think, again, it comes back to political leadership and an unwillingness among our current generation of leaders to challenge these taboos in British society. Immigration is one. The National Health Service is another. Merely suggesting that we should have a different way of funding and reforming the healthcare system is seen as being outside of what we call in political science the Overton window, the range of acceptable discourse. So what we end up doing is lurching from one year to another, throwing money into this National Health Service while not talking as well to British people about things like prevention. We need to be working much more actively at preventing escalating increases in obesity, for example. We're rapidly following America on that issue as well. We have record levels of so-called deaths of despair or slow-motion suicides through things like alcohol and drug abuse, especially in those industrial communities that were left to rot after the 1980s. Lots of these issues I think we need to think and talk much more seriously about, but we have to shake up this status quo, Michael, because it's clearly not working.
I know you're not a social scientist, but political economy covers a fairly wide range. But tell me, I read somewhere recently the statistics showed that 21% of the population of England and Wales, of the working age population, is economically inactive. How could that be?
Well, again, many people in Britain don't want to talk about this, but we have nearly 5 million working age people relying on welfare benefits. A large number
of
those.
What is the working age population, roughly speaking?
18 to 60, 65, around that sort of area.
And in numbers of people?
Nearly 5 million.
5 million. Yeah.
Working age people not in the economy. Yeah. Some of that is a hangover from COVID. Yeah. We had lots of people say, they're unwell, they've got mental health issues. But to be honest, a lot of that has been coming since the 2000s when the welfare state was expanded and lots of people were pushed onto it, and therefore not really having much dignity and meaning and purpose in their lives. The Conservative Party, in my view, has fundamentally failed to reform welfare in a way that you would need to do in order to push those people back into a meaningful existence. And what we're doing now, and this is perhaps a controversial point, we're not even talking about the welfare problem because we're plugging the gaps by relying on bringing workers in from overseas. And this is where I think we've got a leadership class in Britain which isn't really interested in investing in British people. You know, give you another example, you look at, say, the NHS, which we just discussed. Most of our doctors now are brought in from abroad because we don't want to expand the number of medical places for British kids. So we turn away 20,000 applications every year, 20, 30,000 from British kids who want to become doctors.
Just in medicine, 20,000?
Because we don't have medical places.
My God.
Yeah, we don't have medical places.
Okay.
So because we say it's too expensive, right? Yet we're spending all of this money on other initiatives. So I think this is where you can see in the Conservative Party, especially, an emerging debate similar to America, which is it time to begin to think much more seriously about organizing politics around some kind of principle of national preference? And by that I mean ensuring that the NHS, companies, institutions, universities prioritize domestic British workers before relying on this model, which is basically dependent upon import.
As long as they're trained.
Cheap labour. Well, the problem is they're often not trained. I mean, you know, British working class kids are not entering the education system or staying in the system anywhere near as much as they should be. Mm. I can tell you as a university lecturer, some of the kids that I teach, to be blunt, shouldn't be at university.
And the migrant class or their children seem to do better. They aspire.
Oh, they routinely outperform British kids at every level of the education system, which is fantastic. But again, this is, you know, in my role as a social mobility commissioner, this again challenges one of the big narratives we have about Britain. We say Britain is a terrible place where nobody can thrive and nobody can prosper.
It's not true. On the contrary. It's not true.
Many, many kids, often from minority backgrounds, are thriving. Yet actually it's often working class kids from families that have been in Britain for generations who don't have that aspiration and who don't have strong families, Michael. Mm. This is another taboo we're not allowed to talk about. The extent to which Britain now has the highest rates of family breakdown.
Well, we're going to talk about
Western
it. We're going to talk. I mean, unfortunately, it's a very big question. It's something that interests me, being a family man and with children in different places and grandchildren in different places. What does the data show? What does the data say, Matt, about family life in the UK? I mean, what is the state of the traditional family, if I sound really old-fashioned, father, mother, children? Does the data show that children have better life prospects in traditional families? And what does the data say, and I really want to know what the facts are, about children being brought up by one parent? How much of are minority families, you've touched on it, where two men or two women are raising children? Is their voice disproportionate in the debate on families and family life? And is the traditional family under threat when government policy, it seems to me, is to encourage mothers to go back to work as quickly as possible after the birth and leave the children with so-called carers or in creches or with, I mean, grandparents or aunts or the extended family? Am I misinformed, Matt? Does your academic work analyse societal and economic changes in this important area? Sorry, such a long question.
No, let me answer it both as an academic and somebody whose parents divorced when I was five, because I have a very strong interest in this. Britain not only has the highest rates of family breakdown in the Western world, but by the end of this decade, we'll have record numbers of single-parent families. And the evidence in terms of what happens to children from those families is overwhelming. Mm. So we recently had a report by the Nuffield Foundation which showed that 43% of all British kids are no longer living with their mum and dad by the time they turn 18.
So nearly half.
Nearly half.
Yeah.
I find that statistic utterly depressing and striking. We also know that the kids who do end up in broken homes are much more likely to go through the criminal justice system, leave school early, not go to university, not do well, suffer from mental health issues and a whole range of other problems. And we know that, as somebody once said, it is simply much easier to raise strong children than it is to fix broken adults. But what we have are political leaders who are unwilling to do the things you need to do to build a pro-family economy. And I'll give you one example. Our new Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, recently changed the system to try and encourage mums and dads to get back to work as soon as possible after having kids.
I saw that, yes.
Now, how on earth is that going to help build sustainable, strong family environments over the long term? Why aren't we having a serious conversation in Britain about not only how to improve and uphold strong families, but, and again, this is a controversial point, how we can encourage people to have more kids? Because if you look at Britain over the longer term, we, like most Western democracies, are heading into a demographic time bomb, right? It's about to explode. We aren't having enough kids. And what we're doing in order to try and deal with that is encourage more migration, which then creates this never-ending spinning loop of having a society that is constantly churning because we don't have pro-family policies that are encouraging people to invest seriously. And I just think I was speaking at a conference recently in London where a number of MPs made this point that unless we simultaneously support families and invest in building a country that recognises and promotes strong family development, we're going to have a serious problem. And those MPs were roundly attacked in the media for promoting an argument that was seen to be reactionary, that was seen to be right-wing, that was seen to be old-fashioned. Let me just say one thing, Michael. As the child of divorced parents, when I hear people say family breakdown is reactionary or talking about family is old-fashioned, I would say those people know absolutely nothing about what they're talking about. It's the most important thing, and it's the greatest investment any society can make. Just look at it from a GDP perspective. You want a strong growing economy, have strong families, right? You want to resolve the housing crisis, have strong families, right? Because you don't want people breaking off into, you know, single dwelling homes and the rest of it. And this is where I think our leaders are incredibly short-sighted. They're not even kind of reflecting on the longer-term policy challenges that we're facing as a society.
Matt, you've opened up another debate, which we haven't got time to go into now, on the importance of family life. I'm an advocate of that. I agree 100% with what you've just said. I thank you for answering all my questions clearly, quickly, not easy topics to discuss, and I really hope that we can carry this conversation on another date. My guest today has been Dr. Matt Goodwin, Professor of Politics at the School of Politics and International Relations at the University of Kent in England. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me.
That was The McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.